if you just show the RG flow as here on the picture, when you have some theory which starts in a fixed point in the UV and flows somewhere in the infrared, the question of relating scale to conformal invariance is a question of what is going on here at the fixed point. Basically, it's the question of what is the possible structure of the fixed point. The question of irreversibility of the RG flow is somewhat different. It's a question it's a question related to the structure of this flow. So it's not about the final points. It's basically what is going on in between. And at first glance, those two questions are not related to each other. But based on what we know now, based on the examples, based on our knowledge in two dimensions and four dimensions, there are only dimensions where both irreversibility and scale versus conformal questions are solved to some extent. We can see that the question about the flow and the question about the final points are somehow related. The methods, the technology we use to answer both these questions are related. And I want to emphasize that this technique differs from dimension to dimension. In two dimensions, you use a technique which is different from four dimensions. And therefore, I think the right way to look at these things is the following. We should somehow combine those two questions together and try to understand what is the structure behind those two things as a whole. Another important philosophical point which I want to emphasize here is the following. You can ask me how is that possible in the first place that we can make some progress related to the general properties of quantum field theory, which are very, very universal, and why that wasn't done, for example, 10 or 20 years ago. Because the questions like that, they obviously could be formulated long, they were formulated long time ago, and it's not clear why there was no progress along this way. So to answer this question, I would probably tell you that the way how we made the progress, we combined two completely different branches of quantum field theory. We combined two different techniques which were never designed to work together. One technique was the technique of local operators and local fields, something which and path integral language, something which we are very, very familiar when we deal with quantum field theory. And another language is also very established. It's a language of S matrix, but that other language was precisely designed not to talk about local fields and local operators. And usually those two techniques were considered separately and people were not mixing them. And it seems to me that we made progress because we were trying to bring those two approaches together. And this is somewhat difficult because, as I said, those two things were designed not to work on the same level, not to use the same language. And therefore, we made a progress. At one point, we made progress, but the price we paid is that the results we have, we keep them at the level of physical argument. We cannot say that this is a mathematical theorem which is 100% correct. So here we heavily relied on some physical intuition we have about properties of S matrix and what is a good physical theory and so on and so on. All right, the last point before we go into some technical stuff is that this set of questions about the RG flow irreversibility and the structure of the fixed points happens to be related to the new set of questions, in particular the questions relating the Minkowski description to the Euclidean description. Naively, we would think that Euclidean description is equivalent to the Minkowski description. They're related to each other by some sort of analytic continuation. This analytic continuation could be complicated technically, but it's conceptually trivial. But it seems that in practical sense, Minkowski description can give you more than the Euclidean description does. And for example, our proof, or I would better say our argument, that scale invariance plus unitarity implies conformal invariance, we can only formulate it in the Minkowski space. So this result opens or reopens or emphasizes the question of trying to understand unitarity in Euclidean language. We all know that unitarity in the Euclidean language corresponds to reflection reflection positivity, but that doesn't seem to be the final answer here. It doesn't seem like reflection positivity is all what is there, or at least we need to understand the situation better. So this is one important question to understand, and another important question to understand is whether we can try to reformulate the story of S matrix, at least try to reformulate it in the Euclidean language, because our proof is using S matrix in Minkowski space, and there is no way, there is no known way we can try to reformulate the same in the Euclidean space. So basically what I'm trying to say here is that the question of relating scale to conformal invariance should not be considered as a separate mathematical language, as a mathematical theorem, although we can formulate it as such. It should be considered as a set of questions which should be considered altogether. So this is my philosophical view on this. Now let me try to be more specific, to be more technical, and I will start by reviewing Zamolodchik of C theorem in two dimensions, and I will also review a proof that scale invariance implies conformal invariance in two dimensions, and we will base our four-dimensional proof on these calculations. So in two dimensions, the situation is very, very simple. It's very simple conceptually, and it's very simple technically. This is because the object we want to study, the two-point function of stress-energy tensors, is encoded by only one scalar function. So let me first say why I'm considering two-point function of stress-energy tensors. This is because I want to consider something which is called central charge in two dimensions. Conformal symmetry, if I have CFT in two dimensions, conformal symmetry completely fixes two-point function of stress-energy tensors up to an overall coefficient, which is called central charge. So if I want to study this central charge, I have to consider two-point function of stress-energy tensors. If I go off criticality in any theory which is Lorentz invariant, because T mu nu is conserved, the two-point function, despite indices here, is characterized by one scalar function f. Okay, so this is a very simple statement, but it's crucial here because only one function means that I can study any particular combination of indices here, and I will know the result for all other combinations of indices. As I said, this is a trivial statement, but this is the key why we can prove so much in two dimensions. We can prove irreversibility, and we can prove scale versus conformal. So if the theory is conformal, then this function is just a linear function. C is a central charge, and S is just P squared. I probably need to explain why if function f is linear, this is a conformal theory. This is because if you look at this formula carefully, and you contract indices mu and nu, and you contract indices rho and sigma, then trace of stress-energy tensor and another trace of stress-energy tensor, the two-point function, would be just equal to f. These guys will cancel with maybe some numerical coefficient. And then if f is just a polynomial in momentum, if f is a contact term, then in the coordinate space, that would be just a delta function, which means that the two-point function of traces is zero at the separate points. And because of unitarity, it means that the trace is zero as an operator. And that means that the theory is a CFT. OK, that's why this linear function means that it's a conformal theory. Now, if I want to study difference between central charges, and that's the Zamolodchik of C theorem, which says that the difference between central charges, CUV minus C infrared, is a positive quantity, then I just need to calculate basically F prime at infinity and F prime at zero. And I use the sum rule, I use the dispersion relation to immediately arrive at this formula. So this is not the usual, this is not the usual way how people write it, but we will be mostly dealing with this Minkowski and momentum space representation of the sum rule. And because imaginary part of this function f, it's an imaginary part of the two-point function, has to be positive, the delta c is also positive. OK, that's the end of the proof. So it was very simple. Basically, I could say that I managed to prove the Zamolodchik of C theorem without even understanding conceptually or physically what I was doing. I was just doing some formal manipulations with a two-point function. I didn't have any underlying idea. This is good, but this is also very bad, because now when I have to go into four dimensions, the fact that I didn't really realize what was the idea in two dimensions will fail me. I won't be able to generalize this. Now, of course, you can go into coordinate space and rewrite this sum rule in a more familiar form. And of course, in this representation, the two-point function is positive because of the reflection positivity. And this is just manifestation, Euclidean and coordinate space manifestation, that the imaginary part of this guy is positive. Okay, but again, at the level of two-point function, this is just a simple analytical continuation at the level of Fourier transform. This is a trivial form of mathematical manipulation. Okay. Now, let me repeat those lessons once again. I proved the Zamolodchikov C theorem quite easily by deriving the sum rule, but I did not distinguish between Minkowski language and Euclidean language. All those languages were equivalent, mathematically equivalent, up to trivial analytic continuation, up to going and coordinate space and momentum space were also equivalent because I could do Fourier transform. There are fancy names I can assign to those trivial mathematical manipulations. For example, if I want to say that imaginary part is positive and relate that to unitarity in the usual way, to relate it to the positive norm of the state, I can call this a Cullen-Lemon representation. If I want to go to the coordinate space in an Euclidean and say that two-point function is positive, then this trivial manipulation will be called an Osterwalder-Schroeder theorem. So there are fancy names, but the essence is trivial. And unfortunately, it will be very difficult to generalize this to generalize the important part of that to four dimensions, because all those theorems are there, but it's not clear what to do with them and how to do that. And essentially, all those theorems, like Osterwalder-Schroeder theorem, will be basically helpless. They will not help us much in four dimensions. Okay, so the last thing is scale versus conformal on two dimensions. It's also not very complicated to prove. I will probably do it on the next slide. But it's also related to the two-point function. And it's also based on the sum rule. So basically, everything is in this formula. The last thing, I want to actually give you yet another way to derive the same result in two dimensions. And I will try to do it in a completely unnatural way, which is, from the two-dimensional point of view, it's a completely unnatural, forced way to do things. It will be mathematically equivalent to what I already have done. And it could be even strange to see that I'm doing exactly the same once again, just using new formalism here. But I'm doing that precisely because this language somehow happens to be the correct language in four dimensions. So idea is, again, to rederive this sum rule. I will start from the bottom. The idea is to derive the sum rule. But because I have two-point function here, it will be more convenient for me to work with the generating functional of connected diagrams. So I will introduce the object, which is a generated functional of connected diagrams. It can be introduced in this way. And then the two-point function is just a second variational derivative of this functional. And then one can try to see what is the general form of this functional based on the symmetries. There will be one non-local term which is guaranteed by the conformal anomaly. This is the famous Polyakov's action. And there will be all possible local terms. The local term with the smallest number of derivatives, which is linear in the Ricci curvature, in the curvature tensor, it's a full derivative in two dimensions. It's an Euler density. So this guy disappears. All other guys have higher corrections. They don't contribute at the level of two-point function. And then essentially, if you go through this path, you see that this integral is indeed related to the delta C. That's how you derive the same result we already had. But apparently, the language of generating functional will be the correct language in four dimensions. OK. So. So maybe I can say one more thing about the previous thing. At this point, this tau was not a dynamical field. It was just a background field. If I really wanted to, I can try to say that tau is dynamical. And the only situation when really tau has to be dynamical is if I really wanted to prove, if I really wanted to choose this way to prove that this imaginary cut is positive. As you know, you don't have to declare this external particle to be dynamical for this imaginary part to be for this imaginary cut to be positive. You don't have to do that. But for example, in the Landau-Lifschitz textbook, they use this path. They say that this particle, it can be promoted to be a dynamical particle. Then this imaginary cut is equal to the width of this particle. It's related to the observable decay rate. And because of that, it has to be positive. Okay, so we will do something similar in four-dimensional space. But in two-dimensional space, I want to emphasize, you could declare this tau to be dynamical, but that was definitely not necessary. It's more like if you really wanted to, you could get away with that, but it was an excess. In four dimensions, unfortunately, there is no other viable option but just to declare tau to be dynamical. Okay, another important slide is how we can prove scale versus conformal in two dimensions. This is an important language lesson to learn. The proof is very, very simple. So I will first try to confuse you a little bit to keep the complexity at the level. So the proof is really, really simple. Basically, what you say in two dimensions is the following. You consider this function f, and remember, this function f is just a two-point function of traces. If you take traces here, it will just have f here. And then you say, if you have a theory which is scale invariant, which means that it doesn't depend on any dimensionful parameter, then what f could be? And the only viable option is just to say that f is linear in S, right? Because f has non-trivial dimension. And because it's linear in S, I already explained that this is a conformal field theory. Okay? So to give some essence to two-dimensional proof, I'll try to first work hard to convince you that perhaps having log of this sort is OK. And then I will show very quickly that it is not OK. But this will not be a wasted time. It will not be a wasted time, of course, because in four dimensions, the situation will be very similar, meaning that you might have this log. But it will be very, very difficult to show that this log could not be there. And the whole point of four-dimensional argument we have is to reintroduce the way, if you wish, how we can make sure that this log cannot appear here. So let's first consider two dimensions. Why on earth having a log which is explicitly dependent on mu on a dimensionful parameter could be OK? Okay? If you forget about, if you just look at the meaning of f, and the f is a two-point function of two traces, then this mu is a dimensionful parameter, but you could say that the physical observable is not dependent on mu. Because if you change mu, the full correlator only changes by ks. K is a constant, s is a polynomial in momentum, which means that if you change mu, the two-point function of traces changes only by the contact term. So the physical observable, which is the correlator at the separate points, doesn't change. It doesn't depend on mu. What is mu dependent is the contact term itself. And because contact term is not necessarily physical, then you can quickly declare that mu is OK. Okay? In two dimensions, of course, you cannot be fooled, because you know that this function controls not only the trace, but all other components as well. For example, consider the component 0, 1, 0, 1. It will be explicitly log mu dependent. And if you differentiate with respect to mu, you will have a difference at separate points. So in two dimensions, this log mu is not allowed, period. But what will happen in four dimensions, it will be completely unclear which physical observable we should consider to exclude this kind of log mu's. Okay? So our point was that instead of considering certain correlation function as it was done in two dimensions, here we consider T01, T01. Instead of considering a particular correlation function in four dimensions, we should consider a certain scattering amplitude. The scattering amplitude is also physical, and if you can show that it is explicitly log mu dependent, then it's not good, okay? But basically, in two dimensions, we have already proved everything. Because this log mu is not okay, then the only viable option is here, and this is a conformal field theory, end of story. Any questions about two dimensions? Okay.
Just a quick question. Why do you call this Polchinski theorem? I thought this was a result proved by Lüscher and Mack.
Because I read about this in Polchinski's paper, I guess. Okay.
So that's a match.
And I also heard other people using this name, but
it's just a match.
Oh, I probably put some butter or something.
Can we survive this? Yeah? Okay, sorry. All right. Every time you ask me a challenging question, I will do that. All right. Now, so we try to generalize what we learn in two dimensions to other dimensions. So first of all, something like C theorem can be formulated, actually was formulated for any even dimension. So the idea was back suggested by Cardi back in, I think, 1986. The conformal anomaly in any even dimensional space consists of Euler density plus something which I can colloquially say is is built out of wild tensors. This is not entirely true, but for our purposes, that will be true. This is called A anomaly. This is called B-type anomaly. And if you put a theory on a sphere, which is a conformally flat manifold, then all B anomaly type terms will disappear. But the A anomaly type term will produce a finite result. So if you consider a theory on a sphere and calculate the expectation value of the trace of the stress energy tensor, then this expectation value will be proportional to this Euler density coefficient in front of the Euler density. In two dimensions, this is C. In four dimensions, this is A, and so on and so on. So Cardy suggested that this is the right coefficient, which will decrease along the flow. He didn't prove this theorem or conjecture, but he gave a heuristic argument why this should be the case. He said, let's put a theory on a sphere. And now theory is not necessarily conformal because I want to have a non-trivial RG flow. And the radius of the sphere will play the role of the energy scale in my theory. And I will slightly change the radius. And I can calculate the derivative of this expectation value with respect to the radius. If you change the radius, you change the metric. Because of changing the metric, you will have another trace of the stress energy tensor going from the exponent to the pre-exponent. So you will have something like that. The derivative of the expectation value with respect to the energy scale is proportional to the integral of the two-point function over the whole sphere. In this case, I wrote down in four dimensions. Now, because of the reflection positivity or because of unitarity, this two-point function is manifestly positive or non-negative. And therefore, this contribution is positive. There is perhaps minus sign. And this is an irreversible flow, right? The delta A will be always positive. Now, this is a good heuristic argument. Unfortunately, it's not rigorous. And there is no known way to make it rigorous. The way why this is not working is because you have to integrate over the whole space here, including the coincident points. The correlator at the coincident points is not well defined. You will have to introduce ambiguities related to renormalization. And basically, your result will be dependent on regularization. You will not be able to show that you will have a physically invariant non-negative answer here. So some people did a very careful analysis, including regularization and everything. It was the best analysis, I think, was done by Hugh Osborne, who demonstrated that if you start in the vicinity of a CFT, when you're very close to the CFT, then indeed the answer is positively definite. But as soon as you walk a finite difference away from the CFT, there is no known way to show that the resulting expression is indeed positive definite. OK, so it's a good heuristic argument, but unfortunately, it cannot be promoted to be a rigorous proof. OK, now, as I already announced, the proof or the argument of scale versus conformal is based on the same technique as the proof of A theorem. So we'll have to talk about A theorem. And I want to emphasize that this technique is different from two dimensions, but it seems like A theorem and scale versus conformal are related in all dimensions, at least based on two dimensions, two and four. Based on two cases we know, this always seems to be the case. I do not know any philosophical reason for that, but I think it's an interesting point to think about. So before we go into proof of A theorem, I want to remind you what was known before the recent work by Kamargoski and Schwimmer. People thought about A theorem in four dimensions for many years. So there was some intuition. There was some intuition how this proof should work. People realize very clearly that the A theorem is living inside four-point function. This is because the stress energy tensor is equal to A multiplied by the Euler density. The Euler density is proportional to the R squared. So there is no A sitting in two-point function. You have to consider three or four-point function or higher point functions. People also realized that three-point function would unlikely give you something useful because there is no positivity constraints. In two dimensions, we clearly use positivity of the two-point function related to unitarity. There are similar constraints for four-point function, for any even number point functions, because positivity coming from unitarity always works the following. You have something symmetric, you cut it in half, and you declare the whole thing to be a modulus of something, modulus squared of something. So with a three-point function, there is no way to do it. So you have to consider something like four-point function of stress energy tensors. But it was known that here you have literally hundreds of structures, hundreds of functions, not one, but as it was in two dimensions, hundreds of functions here, and perhaps you will have a dozen, I don't know, handful of positivity constraints. So it was not clear how to distill the correct function here, which will govern A, and at the same time will have certain positivity properties, okay? That was a challenging task. People tried to do it, but they didn't go very far, okay? And then at this point, people did not really distinguish between Minkowski and Euclidean space because the main object they were working with was the correlation function. The correlation function lives equally well in Minkowski or Euclidean space. So apparently, some of those things, well, apparently this way of looking at the problem was partially responsible for why we waited so long before somebody came up with the successful proof of the A theorem. For example, as I will try to demonstrate right now, if you try to formulate everything in terms of correlation functions such that Minkowski space and Euclidean space are kept at the equal level, then it will be very difficult to do. The crucial point of the Komorgowski-Schwimmer proof is that it is formulated in the Minkowski space. It doesn't work with the correlation functions. It works with the scattering amplitude. And also, you can try, after you see the proof, to reformulate everything in this language. You will not gain anything. Even if you succeed reformulating their proof in this language, you will not gain anything by going back to this language. So this proof is definitely using scattering amplitudes as a useful tool rather than correlation functions. So let's speak just a little bit about the difference between Minkowski and Euclidean space. I will remind you that there is an Osterwalder-Schroeder theorem which basically says that unitarity in Minkowski space is equivalent to what is called reflection positivity in the Euclidean space. If you have a positivity of norm of some state with, let's say, n phis, then in Euclidean space, it means that you have a correlator with two n phis. And this full correlator, including the disconnected parts, has to be positive. So there is an exact equivalence between the two. And it is established with clever analytic continuation, if you wish. It's a clever mathematical trick. But it's rigorous. And as much as you know about this, you will immediately know about this and so on. And vice versa. I mean, meaning that there is as much information here as there is information here. Okay, so. But apparently, there are other ways in Minkowski space to utilize unitarity. Strictly speaking, this is what unitarity is, and there is nothing else. This is a complete set of conditions for theory to be unitary. But apparently, there are clever ways to use unitarity in the Minkowski space such that you cannot reformulate them in this language, and then you cannot reformulate them in this language. So one of the examples was given by the paper by Dubovsky et al., I think, in 2008. And this is, I guess, a well-known example by now. They say the following. They say, let's consider some UV-complete quantum field theory, which is unknown. And let's integrate some degrees of freedom up to the scale lambda. And let's consider the low-energy effective field theory, which lives below lambda. And let's assume that this low-energy Lagrangian consists of one massless field phi. And this Lagrangian is correct up to the scale lambda. And this Lagrangian has the following form, okay? Now, epsilon is some unknown parameter, but using unitarity in Minkowski space, we will prove in a second that this epsilon has to be positive, okay? And this is done in a clever way of using dispersion relation. First, we say, let's consider 2 into 2 scattering of these particles phi. Then this 2 into 2 scattering amplitude, we can calculate it using perturbative language. We calculate the leading Feynman diagram, which contributes to this scattering. This is just a diagram, three-level diagram with this vertex. So this is the contribution. From another point of view, we can write down the dispersion relation for this scattering amplitude. This dispersion relation has to be exact, meaning that there are no subtractions. This is because in the infrared, you can use this Lagrangian, and there are enough derivatives here to actually show that this integral converges in the infrared. This integral is also convergent in the UV because you assume your theory is renormalizable, although you do not know what the theory is in the UV. And therefore, there are no subtractions. So this is a true statement. This is a true equality with no other terms, infinities, or anything like that. Therefore, you can differentiate this quantity twice, here and here. And here you will just have epsilon. And here you will have an integral of an explicitly positive quantity. Therefore, epsilon has to be positive. Now, we proved that in the Minkowski space, there is no known way to reformulate that in the Euclidean space. So despite the fact that it seems like unitarity is represented by reflection positivity, we do not know how to use it in a meaningful way to prove, for example, that epsilon has to be positive. OK, so that creates the following question, which I do not know answer to. The question is the following: whether reflection positivity is everything, encompasses all manifestations of unitarity in the Euclidean space. Okay? So I will just read, because sometimes when I try to say it by memory, I invert the definition, and then yes becomes no. So if reflection positivity is all unitarity implies in Euclidean space, there are two options. Whether it could be yes or no, we can say yes, which means that there is actually a way to prove that epsilon is positive using reflection positivity. But the problem here is that we don't know this way. And for many years or now, 6 years by now, maybe five, people try to do it, but there is no even an idea how to do it. So then we can say that perhaps, OK, reflection positivity is not everything what we can say about theory in the Euclidean space. So the answer would be no. But this is also very, very strange, because we have Osterwalder-Schroeder theorem, which tells us that definitely reflection positivity ensures that all states have positive norm. And if you think about definition of unitarity, this is the definition of unitarity. The property that this imaginary part is positive is just related to the fact that all states have positive norm. So the answer no is also not a satisfactory answer, or at least doesn't look like a good answer. So then there could be yet another answer, maybe, meaning that perhaps reflection positivity is all it is there. But the reason why we cannot use it in a constructive way to prove anything about positivity of epsilon is because low energy questions in Minkowski space become questions at all energies in Euclidean space. Meaning that what we could consider at the level of low energy theory in Minkowski space, we could not consider at the level of an effective theory in Euclidean space. We have to know the UV Lagrangian. And because we don't know the UV Lagrangian, then we will not be able to use reflection positivity to prove anything. Now, I'm not saying this is the right answer, although I think it is, because I don't have a proof. And I think it would be very interesting to actually construct a productive way to maybe an example to convince, I don't know, it would be good to somehow make a progress here and convince ourselves that maybe this is indeed the correct resolution of this small puzzle. That maybe indeed reflection positivity is everything unitarity can tell you in the Euclidean space. But the low energy questions are not translated into low energy questions in Euclidean space. They are translated into all energy questions in the Euclidean space. Have a question?
Are you saying that somehow large distance effective theory in the Euclidean would not
suffice? That's what everybody was thinking, right? But you clearly see a problem here. You have a proof which is based on low distance behavior in Minkowski space, and there is no way how you can translate this proof in a Euclidean space, keeping only long distances. It might be, yes, that might be not enough. If you want to do analytic continuation, it might be that you have to keep information about short distances as well.
But Minkowski, you can go on the light cone, right? So you can have x differences of coordinates being very small, even though actually they're.
Are you on my side or on his side?
I think I'm on your side.
Okay, good.
Well, you can see this. So if you go on one limit is a light cone, so you.
It is. Well, it is true that we know examples, for example, light cone, that there are certain things in Minkowski which are not present in Euclidean. But usually, you don't just consider light cone. You have a final goal. And usually, those final questions, final goals, you can translate into Euclidean and successfully prove in Euclidean, right? But apparently, there are questions which you cannot answering Euclidean, and Litecoin is a part of the of that story because there are, besides this scattering amplitudes, there are also this energy correlators which use this Litecoin limit, I believe. And I think this also difficult to formulate in the Euclidean space. So besides besides this story with 2 × 2 scattering unitary cuts, there is other example. I wanted to talk about that at the very last slide as like further directions. Okay, so at least this is something to think about. Apparently, Euclidean space in practical sense has certain disadvantages. So we will try to formulate everything in the Minkowski space. It's good that somebody did it before us, namely Komargotsky and Schwimmer. And they just basically use the result, this cute result with positivity of a parameter epsilon, and they apply this result to the A theorem. And that's how they did it. They introduced the generating functional of the connected diagrams in a particular flow, which starts from a CFT and it ends with a CFT. Because of certain symmetries, they were able to calculate the form of this action up to certain number of unknown coefficients. But apparently, one coefficient is controlled by the anomaly, and it is universal. And a lucky observation was the key observation, and they were lucky. I do not know any conceptual reason for that. They were lucky in a sense that 2 × 2 scattering of those particles, after you promote those particles to be dynamical, happen to be controlled only by the anomaly, only by the universal term. Namely, if you write down the effective Lagrangian, and this is the effective Lagrangian, this is the effective action, but this is basically the generating function of kinetic diagrams, and plus the kinetic term because you want to promote this field to be dynamical, then it explicitly resembles the example we had 2 slides ago. We had d phi to the fourth. Here we have d tau to the fourth. The coefficient here is delta A. They also have an elaborate kinetic theorem, which is dictated by symmetries, but basically because it's this part is generating functional of kinetic diagrams, the kinetic theorem you add by hands. It is motivated by symmetries, but you can just say, I want this kinetic term, period. It's up to you which kinetic term to add. Then if you consider 2 × 2 scattering and just use this trick with the imaginary part and dispersion relation, then you will prove that the analog of epsilon, which is delta A, is positive. Okay, so that's how they prove the A theorem. Okay, so this is the corresponding dispersion relation. And there are a list of questions which this proof doesn't seem to answer. So first, there is no coordinate space formulation. And because there is not coordinate space, or maybe because of other reasons, there is really no A function. There is A theorem meaning that delta A is positive. AUV is larger than A infrared. But there is no A function which would monotonically change along the flow like in two dimensions. There is no Euclidean formulation. One important question which, for example, I had when I saw this proof was the following. What is the role of dynamical tau? Is it really necessary to have this dilaton dynamical? Maybe we can go back to the original language of correlation functions and reformulate everything in terms of correlation functions, and maybe it will be even better. So I was really resistant to believe that this dynamical dilaton is something important. So this is one of the questions. And then another thing is that now we have the scattering picture, but it was not clear if this is the right picture. Those two questions are actually related. It was not clear if this is the right picture because it was proven shortly after a Komargotsky-Schwimmer paper, but that this scattering of dilatons picture doesn't work in 6 dimensions. There were some problems. People could not prove A theorem in 6 dimensions using this technique. Okay, so these were the questions, but let me say that I think now I can answer this question. The following proof, from now on, for the last 20 minutes, I will be talking about the intended topic of my talk today, the scale versus conformal. I will use this technique to argue that by some modifications, we can use this technique to show that scale invariant theory has to be conformal. But we will rely heavily on dynamical dilaton. We will actually generalize 2 × 2 scatterings into n into n scatterings and so on and so on. So at least I think we have answered one of the questions. I think one of the questions, whether dynamical dilaton is a necessity, I think this is correct. I think we do have we do have need to have a dynamical dilaton. Yes, he had a second paper, and besides that, there was a paper by Luty, Polchinsky, and Ratazzi. In his second paper, he came very close to reformulate everything in the all language. Also, if you try to think about it, if you try to formulate the positivity constraint, which comes to the imaginary part, if you speak about scattered amplitude, this is trivial. You just say imaginary part of the amplitude is trivial. But imaginary part of the diagram to be positive, this is a non-trivial statement. And there is no rigorous proof if you think about it. It can be only established within perturbation theory, because you can apply Kutkowski rules to any to Feynman diagrams at any level of the perturbative expansion and Compli constant. So for perturbative theory, you can show that indeed you can get away with the old language. But you're not gaining anything by using old language, and this is my point. You can prove everything using new language. Then, as an exercise, you can go back and reformulate in the old language. But you see that this is not a natural language anymore. Okay. Okay. So now I want to speak a little bit about the paper by Luty, Polchinsky, and Ratazzi. First of all, they came very close to reformulating everything in the old language of correlation functions. But as I said, I don't think they gained anything by doing that. But more importantly, they also made some progress relating scale invariants to conformal invariants. So basically, they had a very crucial observation, which we will use. But let me first explain what they did in their paper. They wanted to prove that scale invariance implies conformal invariance. And the way how we established conformal invariance in two dimensions, we demonstrated that the two-point function of t mu mu is zero. That was the standard way to show that the operator is zero, is to consider the two-point function and to show that two-point function is zero. So everything was rotating around the idea that the two-point function has to be zero. In four dimensions, I think this was a wrong path, because in four dimensions, a theory can be conformal without trace of the stress energy tensor being zero. Okay, this is a trivial but important point. If you have a conformal field theory, it means that there is a traceless stress energy tensor, but not every stress energy tensor is traceless. In two dimensions, this is not the case. Basically, if you say that your theory is good, then any stress energy tensor is traceless. But in four dimensions, this is not the case. You can have non-traceless stress energy tensor, and the theory is conformal. It just means that there is a particular improvement term such that it will remove the trace. Therefore, trying to prove that the two-point function of traces in four dimensions is zero, this is wrong. You will never be able to achieve that. This is too much to wish. Okay. Nevertheless, they were following this route, and they were trying to show that the two-point function is zero. And they succeeded partially. So what they did, they started at the vicinity of a genuine CFT. There, they could choose stress energy tensor to be traceless. And in the vicinity of this CFT, they have basically a preferred basis for their stress energy tensor. They consider 2 × 2 scattering amplitude. And this scattering amplitude is given by many diagrams. This is the most natural diagram, which corresponds to the four-point function. But also, there are contributions by the 3- and 2-point function. And because they are working in a close vicinity of the genuine CFT, and this T is considered to be traceless at the CFT, these are sublidian contributions, and only this is a Lidian contribution. So they're back to the two-point function, and there they were able to show that this two-point function has to be zero if you have scale invariance. The way how they did it was very, very simple. And this way is basically, so this way is very similar to what we did in two dimensions already. So you basically have to say that by dimensional analysis, this guy is either a contact term, then you're done, or this is something multiplied by log. Okay? But this log now is more difficult to rule out, because this two-point function has to be considered as a part of this four-point function. I don't want to go into details, but this log is very, very difficult to rule out. And the way how you can rule out that log is by considering the scattering amplitudes and considering this dispersion relation. If you have a log here, then log has a branch cut. And the imaginary part of this branch cut is just proportional to the coefficient in front of the log, which basically means that this imaginary part is non-zero. This imaginary part by dimensional analysis has to be proportional to S squared. And then this integral will diverge. Okay? But we already derived on the previous slide, not us, but Komorgotsky and Schwimmer, they derived the physical meaning of this dispersion relation. This is the difference between delta A's. Delta A's is well defined, it's not renormalizable because these are central charges, and therefore you have a contradiction. If you assume scale invariance, if you have log, you have non-trivial branch cut, and therefore this integral diverges. From another side, it has to be finite. The only possible resolution of this contradiction is to say that the coefficient in front of the log is zero, and therefore there is no log. And if there is no log, then the two-point function is basically a contact term, and you proved what you wanted to. Okay, so that's how Luty, Ratazzi, and Polchinski proved that if you have SFT in the small vicinity of a CFT, then this SFT is also a CFT. They also observe, and this is crucial for us, that if you have this hypothetical SFT, then this imaginary part is zero, which means that 2 into 2 scattering is trivial. So we will build on that. We will not build on this result with the two-point function because, as I explained, trying to prove that the two-point function is zero is a wrong path. Two-point function doesn't have to be zero for theory to be CFT. It doesn't have to be zero. But I think the right point was to consider scattering amplitude and to show that 2 into 2 scattering is trivial. Okay, so that's how we will proceed from here. We write down this effective action, and this effective action is it is exact in tau. It is non-linear, but it is exact in tau up to certain number of derivatives, which means that this anomaly controls not only 2 into 2 scattering, but all low energy scattering of dilatons. This is a new crucial observation which we used in our recent paper. So now if you understand that this delta A controls all possible scatterings, you don't have to consider a dispersion relation only for 2 into 2 scattering. You can consider it for n inter n scattering. Okay? So that's what we will do. We'll try to consider this scattering for n into n. Oh, excuse me. We'll try to consider this dispersion relation for n into n scattering. And we know that it is controlled by delta A. Okay? Now we will do it by induction. Usually the problem with considering, let's say, 3 into 3 scattering is the following. Usually we have the central card, which is okay, which is easy to deal with. But we also have additional cuts, which are complicated, and they may result in a complicated analytic structure of the scattering amplitude. They can also result in effect that imaginary part is not positive anymore. And if we have complicated analytic structure or we have lack of positivity, that would mean that our dispersion relation either doesn't make sense or is not very useful. Okay, I want to emphasize now it will be a very simple trick which will solve all the problems. So I want you to pay attention for the next 30 seconds. If you do pay attention for the first 30 seconds, you will understand very clearly what we did in our paper. We did things by iteration, step by step. First, we know that 2 into 2 scattering is trivial. Why? Because if you have an SFT and it's a non-trivial scattering, the dispersion relation for 2 into 2 diverges. And because you know that some rule relates this dispersion relation integral to the difference of delta A, it has to be finite. So 2 into 2 scattering is trivial. Next, let's consider 3 into 3 scattering. We have a good guy and we have a bad guy. But if you look at the bad guy, you will see that this complicated cut is exactly a cut which appears into 2 scattering. And we have proved already that this is a trivial scattering, which means that this imaginary part is zero. So this guy doesn't contribute, and it means that at the level of 3 into 3 scattering, you have only central cut. Central cut means that you have positivity. And since you have positivity, you can reformulate the dispersion relation and use the same trick once again. You say that at the level of 3 into 3 scattering, if you have scale invariance, this guy will diverge. This guy cannot diverge, therefore it has to be 0. Therefore, 3 into 3 scattering is trivial. Now we can consider 4 into 4 scattering. Because 3 into 3 is trivial, all partial cuts at the level of 4 into 4 are trivial. And therefore, you can step by step prove that all n inter n scatterings are trivial. So that was the most important part of my talk. If you have questions, I will take some questions now. Otherwise, I will just go on and build on what I just derived. Yes.
Can you have additional masses scalars at low energies, and will they?
So the setup we are working with is the following. We try to have SFT in the middle of the flow, such that here you have either a genuine CFT or a mass gap. And therefore, the only massless, truly massless particle in this setup is the dilaton. Otherwise, considering scattering amplitude would not make sense, or may not make sense.
What if I have Gaussian bosons for other global symmetries?
If you have Gaussian bosons for other symmetries, that would probably fit in this setup when you have a genuine SFT at low energies. That genuine SFT decouples from the dilaton. If you have a theory and you know that this theory completely decouples from the dilaton, then you can have it at low energies. What you cannot have at low energies is a dynamical particle which is not decoupled from dilaton and which is massless, because then you might generate some infrared singularities in your S matrix, and that's not okay. So technically speaking, we can only consider scale invariant theories which allow a relevant perturbation such that we will start from SFT and we flow somewhere. If SFT is the infrared point of your RG flow, then our method doesn't work. Okay, so what have we proved so far? We have proved that if we have n inter n scattering with arbitrary n, then the central cut, imaginary cut, is zero, which means that scattering of any number of dilatons inter anything, where this anything is a state in the original CFT, is trivial. So in other words, we just proved that the S matrix of dilaton is trivial. So this is the main statement we have today. OK, now we have the following logical chain. We started with SFT plus unitarity. We used that to show that the dilaton has trivial S matrix. Now, and that was, I believe, a rigorous step. Now, I will try to convince you that from here we can try to argue that the resulting theory must be a CFT. That would be a little bit more challenging because we lack formal tools here. Here, to formulate that something is a CFT, we have to formulate that certain operator vanishes. So it's a statement about local fields and operators. And here we have a statement about S matrix. So these are two different languages which we try to bridge together. The way how we will do it using physical intuition. I will put forward the following assertion, which is very intuitive, and therefore you might agree with me. But I lack formal proof to say that this is indeed always so. So the assertion is the following. If you have a particle which has trivial S matrix, all scatterings of this matrix are trivial, then I believe you can have a change of variables in the path integral. And the field which describes this particle upon a corresponding change of variables will be described by a free field, meaning that the Lagrangian for this field would be just d phi squared and nothing else. The reverse statement is definitely true. If you have a path integral with d phi squared, the scattering is trivial. This is obvious. But to prove that any trivial S matrix would imply that there is a change of variable such that the corresponding field is just it has a free Lagrangian, this is more challenging. This sounds very intuitive, and I think you will not be able to find a counterexample. But I lack formal proof that this is always the case. If you grant me this, if you trust that this is indeed a rigorous statement, and we can build on that, then we will do the following simple calculation. We start with the original dilaton. And this is a kinetic term for the dilaton. This is the way how dilaton couples to the trace of the stress energy tensor. And then upon certain change of variables, I want this to be d phi tilde squared. This can only be done if my stress energy tensor, the trace, is a box of some local operator. Then there is a change of variables, as is shown here, such that the whole thing becomes a free Lagrangian. Okay. So from here, I derive that my trace better be a box of some local operator. If my trace is a box of some local operator, then this local operator is exactly the improvement I need to make my trace traceless, to make my stress energy tensor traceless. Okay? So basically, as soon as I demonstrated this, this is already the end. That means my theory is a CFT. Okay? So basically, that's the end of my argument. It consists of two steps. So this is a more rigorous step. I start with SFT plus unitarity, and I have demonstrated that I have a trivial dilat on S matrix. And there is another step where I argue that this implies that my theory is a CFT because my trace has to be a box of something. All right, now I have a controversial slide because I have a counterexample. But this is not a counterexample which disproves my proof. This is a counterexample which disproves the whole assertion that unitarity plus SFT implies CFT. Basically, there is an example of a scale invariant theory which is unitary, which is not conformal. This example is extremely simple. This is just a free scalar field, but I decided to identify phi with phi plus constant, which means that in my theory, I don't allow any operator where phi comes without a derivative. It's a usual free scalar, but I just projected out all operators where phi comes without a derivative. This is a consistent theory. For example, you can prove that by considering OPE of two operators where phi comes with the derivatives. It's clear that in the OPE, the only operators which will appear are those where phi has derivatives, okay? So this is a consistent theory, but now the improvement operator I need is phi squared, and phi squared is not allowed. Okay, so I have a counterexample. Something doesn't work. The case with the scalar field is, of course, a little bit special, because you can say that perhaps what this example is telling us is that if I have SFT plus unitarity, it means it's not a CFT. It might not be a CFT itself, but it has to be a subsector of CFT. Because my argument here shows that such local L has to be present. Therefore, my logic suggests that I am working in a subsector of a CFT. So that wouldn't be such a bad story. But there is a complication. I can consider this theory, and I can dualize it such that a scalar with a projected out zero mode will be described by a free two-form. The situation with a two-form is more complicated because in a theory of two-form, there is really no local phi squared. So this is the counterexample. But I believe it's not a very important counterexample because the theory of free two-form is very special. It's a non-interacting theory, and there is no way to make it interacting. And basically, the reason why this theory can live is precisely because it's rigid, and and you cannot modify it. You cannot add any coupling. You cannot add any interaction. And that's probably behind the fact that you can have certain set of operators and not have other ones. Because the example with scalar fields clearly suggests that more natural realization of this theory would include operators like that. So basically, the moral here is the following. We have a formal counterexample, but it's a very special counterexample, which is based on non-interacting theory. And we believe that this counterexample is not something very important. We should not think too much about it. And if you want to have a technical assumption, what kind of theory, what kind of scale invariant unitary theory would indeed be CFT, then I would say that any scale invariant unitary theory which allows perturbations or which allows interaction would indeed be CFT without any further assumptions. Okay. Which words? In two dimensions, there are other counterexamples, but there are also weird. But there is a whole list of counterexamples in two dimensions. But usually, in two dimensions, what happens is that you don't have two-point function of stress energy tensors; it just diverges. Because Polchinski proof works with the two-point function of stress energy tensors. And if you have two-point function which diverges, then there is no proof. OK, so one important thing which we learned from this story, I believe, is that dynamical dilaton was indeed very necessary. I think this is the right message here. There was a paper recently which declared that dynamical dilaton is not necessary. There is another path to prove that scale invariance implies conformal invariance. But this proof is actually not consistent with this free two form, because this proof is based on the fact, is based on the idea that if you consider operator product expansion and you impose scale invariance, then those two things will be only consistent if your theory is in fact conformal invariant. I believe this is not true. I believe if you have operator product expansion and scale invariance without conformal invariance, this is completely consistent. One example is the two form, if you wish, but you can even consider that at the level of general formulas. So I believe that this is not a good proof. This proof has flaws. And therefore, I want to emphasize that I believe that having a dynamical dilaton is the only viable option, at least for based on what we know now. I think this is basically all I wanted to say. Let me just conclude. Today, I tried to present an argument that SFT plus unitarity implies CFT. I'm hesitant to say that this is a mathematically rigorous proof, especially because we have a counterexample. But I believe I gave the, a physical argument. The narrow point was the transition between the scattering amplitude to the properties of local operators. This is a natural weak point because I'm trying to bridge two separate languages. But this is exactly the reason, I think, why we were able to make the progress. So for the future, I think it would be interesting to try to understand how the language of S matrix can be related in a more complete way to the usual language of local to the correlators of local operators. We should also try to do that in connection with Euclidean space. And as I think somebody said from the audience, besides scattering amplitudes, unitarity plays important roles in energy correlators, and this is related to the light cone direction, which is also not clearly visible in Euclidean space. The most important question, I think, is to understand how one can try to prove a theorem in six dimensions, because we see that when we go into new dimension, the technique changes a lot. And it would be good to have a uniformal approach to all those problems in all dimensions. And if we do have this uniformal approach, then we will be able to say that we eventually found the correct language to talk about those questions. So I think these are the conclusions. Thank you. I guess everything was pretty clear.
And let's thank him at the beginning.